From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two reporters who just returned from covering Africa. We talk with New York Times correspondent Jane Perlez. She was stationed in Nairobi for 4.5 years and was one of the first Western journalists to report on the crisis in Somalia. Her front page article in the Times last July is said to have focused the attention of the Bush administration and the UN on Somalia. Also, we'll talk with journalist Raymond Bonner. He says Africa's next crisis could be in Sudan. In the 1980s, Bonner reported for the Times on the war in El Salvador. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Mad Dog and Glory, starring Robert De Niro and Bill Murray. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI and the Justice Department say a suspect arrested in the bombing of the World Trade Center will be arraigned soon. Prior to the arraignment, officials have released little information about the suspect. Wire Service reports quoted law enforcement sources as saying the suspect is a follower of a radical Muslim cleric who preaches that anyone who stands in the way of Islam should be eradicated. The suspect was reported to have been arrested after he attempted to claim a deposit on a rental van that was destroyed in the explosion. At least 5 people were killed in last Friday's bombing. 1 is still missing and more than 1,000 were hurt. Steve Inskeep reports on the reaction of New Yorkers to today's announcement of an arrest in the World Trade Center explosion.
Just 6 days ago, officials suggested it might take years to track the bombers down. It had taken 2.5 years, for example, to find the Pan Am 103 bombers, who still have not appeared in a courtroom. News of today's arrest has hit New York City like a thunderclap. People at the World Trade Center say they're thrilled by the arrest.
There's been a full-court press by the FBI, the city police department, almost every federal, state, and local agency. This is probably as comprehensive a criminal justice effort as there's been in the United States in quite a while. So I have pretty good faith they find the guy.
The suspect faces arraignment in Manhattan federal court. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in New York.
The White House has turned down a request by the American Medical Association to participate more directly in the White House Task Force on Health Reform. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Since President Clinton was elected, the players in the battle over health care reform have been quietly positioning themselves to influence the outcome. The AMA is now turning up the volume. On Tuesday, the organization sent a letter to the White House outlining its positions on health care reform. The physicians group objected to a government-imposed limit on health care spending, but said it will accept spending goals. The AMA also firmly stated that it would like to be represented on the task force. About 1/10 of the task force working group members are doctors, but none represents the AMA. White House Press Secretary D.D. Meyer said today that the White House wants to work with the AMA, but repeated that they want no special interest groups on the task force. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Bond prices continued to rise today, and bond interest rates fell to new lows. Analysts said that the financial markets are adapting to a new psychology based on the apparent trend toward modest economic growth and low inflation. Inflation tends to erode the value of a bondholder's investment, and low inflation makes bonds look good. On the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 5 points today to close at 3,399. This is NPR News. United Nations and Bosnian officials accused Serbian forces today of stepping up their campaign to expel Muslim civilians from eastern Bosnia. The Yugoslav news agency Tanjug reported that Serbian commanders in Bosnia have offered to give Muslims safe passage out of the region. That offer would reportedly amount to what the Bosnian Serbs have called ethnic cleansing, because the commanders insisted that Muslims and Serbs will never live together again. Unconfirmed reports from eastern Bosnia accused the Serbs of massacres and rapes of civilians, charges that the Serbian military commanders have denied. The Russian parliament called on President Boris Yeltsin today to appear before it tomorrow to account for his role in the increasingly bitter struggle for power now underway in Russia. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
It was Yeltsin's cryptic warning this week that he might resort to the final option that had his opponents in parliament seething today. They accused Yeltsin of preparing to mount a fascist coup, especially after a published report this morning that the top brass of the Russian military had appealed to Yeltsin to be more decisive in resolving the crisis of power now gripping the country. So the members of parliament voted overwhelmingly to demand Yeltsin's presence tomorrow. So far, spokesmen for the Russian president say he will not appear before the parliament. Meanwhile, the parliament has not yet agreed to hold an emergency session of the Congress of People's Deputies next week. Many conservatives in the legislature want that session in order to call off a referendum scheduled for April that is designed to resolve the constitutional crisis within the Russian government. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Orders for manufactured goods fell in January, largely because of weaker demand for aircraft and aircraft parts. The Commerce Department said that factory orders were down by 1.3%, the biggest drop in 5 months. Despite the drop in orders, other statistics for the manufacturing sector were generally positive in January. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the reporters most responsible for alerting Americans to the famine and violence in Somalia was my guest Jane Perlez. From 1988 until the end of 92, she covered Africa for the New York Times. Soon she departs for Warsaw to write about Eastern Europe for the Times. Before she goes, we asked her to talk with us about some of her experiences in Africa, covering the war and famine, the AIDS epidemic, women's issues, and the changes brought about by the end of the Cold War. First, I wanted to know why she thought it was time to leave Africa.
I think that Africa is a fascinating continent, but fortunately or unfortunately, the themes become rather repetitive. And it's a great challenge to come up with different angles on the same themes, but maybe it's good to bring in someone with a different perspective and a fresh mind.
We recently had on a war surgeon named Dr. Chris Yanu, who was the head of surgical operations for about a year in Somalia for the International Committee of the Red Cross. And he said that it was a real turning point when one of your Somalia stories hit the front page of the Times. Do you know the story he was referring to?
Yes, I know it very well. It appeared on Sunday, July 19th, and got very big play with very big pictures. And it is said that President Bush read it, and people at the United Nations read it, and I think the International Committee of the Red Cross, anyway, was very pleased because they had been laboring by themselves for a year and a half under extremely difficult circumstances, and no one was paying any attention. Most of all, the United Nations was not paying any attention. So I think that story did focus a lot of attention on the question of Somalia, and I think in a small way may have led to the very provocative remark by Boutros-Ghali that Yugoslavia was the white man's war and Somalia was the forgotten war.
What was the subject of the story?
The subject of the story was conditions in a town called Baidoa. It's a town a little northwest of Mogadishu. And I went there with photographer Fiona McDougall. We arrived there one evening to stay at the Red Cross house, and we were greeted with some kind of bemusement and a little bit of horror by the two very young Red Cross workers there, because they had been there for 3 weeks and were having a very difficult time adjusting or getting the Somalis to accept them. So these Red Cross workers looked at us and said, well, you're going to have to fend for yourselves. So Fiona and I had come to cover this famine that we had heard about. So we slept in the Red Cross house that night, and the next morning we got up and saw in the main streets of Baidoa a totally indescribable scene. Bodies on the side of the road, people just sort of shuffling along. They were so weak and barely rags. Some people were virtually naked. We went to so-called feeding centers. I call them so-called feeding centers, run by UNICEF, because the gruel and the sort of very thin porridge that was being dished out was too little and too thin, and as fast as the cooks were cooking this very thin, inadequate gruel, the grave diggers were digging graves outside the feeding center. It was an appalling sight.
During those days in the summer when you were traveling around with the photographer through Somalia, did you have protection? Did you hire gunmen?
The Red Cross was enormously helpful to both Fiona and I. And we, in the beginning, used their drivers and their protectors, some of whom had guns. Then when many more journalists came, the Red Cross, of course, couldn't become a conveyor of journalists. They had much more important things to do. So we and other journalists found our own driver, and when you hire a driver in a car and in Somalia, you usually get a couple of rather youthful gunmen who were there really more for deterrence than to do anything offensive. I guess these guys sit in the cars because they are a deterrent to potential looters or robbers of the car.
Well, how did your day-to-day life and your reporting change when more and more press from around the world started arriving in Somalia to cover the story?
Well, I don't think it changed terribly much. I guess by the time the Marines came in December, many people had died, and in many respects, the worst of the famine was over. So I think that it was a bit of a misnomer by the television networks, who I gather gave the impression that the Marines came and instantly saved many, many lives. It's getting a bit off your question, but I guess I felt I had a slightly different perspective, and while television and some reporters were, I gather, filing stories saying that the Marines had saved the day, I think the Marines have done some useful work, but I think it has to be remembered that the bulk of the tragedy was over by the time the Marines got there.
When the American troops landed in Somalia and all the press was there waiting for them and watching, where did you station yourself?
You mean the night they came?
Yeah.
Well, we were very lucky. I was joined in Mogadishu by Donatella Lorch, who is now covering, has the job that I had, based in Nairobi. So she was in Mogadishu, and Eric Schmidt, who is a military correspondent, Pentagon correspondent, was also there. We had two photographers and a technology person. So we were a bureau of six. The night the Marines came, Donatella was down on the beach, and I was up on a balcony at my computer, and Donatella and I had two-way radios, and Donatella beat me over her, walkie-talkie, I should say, I guess, and she would beat me on her walkie-talkie and give me a running commentary of what was going on while I wrote the story from the veranda about a mile away.
Oh, so she basically saw the story, you reported the story.
Well, she reported and saw the story, I wrote it.
Right. Right.
There was no way that we were not sure that if I went to the beach where they were landing, that we would be able to get. I would be able to get out of there to file a story for the 9 o'clock deadline.
Mm-hmm. During the 4 years that you reported from Africa, you saw plenty of drought and famine. Did your personal and professional response change as you saw more and more of it, as it became a more familiar sight?
I don't think so, and I have to say that really the only famine situation that I saw was Somalia. I mean, by the time I got to Africa in 88, the worst of the situation was over in Ethiopia, and while Ethiopia is still very much dependent on imported food, there's not a famine situation. There's drought, but not famine, I would say, except with the exception, I guess, in the Ogaden. So the only famine was Somalia, and it's very hard to get used to. It's very wrenching, and it was easy for me in a way, because I would go for 3 days and leave to go back to Nairobi to file my stories and come back 4 days later and stay for 3 days and leave and go back to Nairobi. I think it's incredibly difficult for the Red Cross workers and the workers of the Irish Concern, who are absolute heroes and heroines. I don't know how they do it, but they have saved a lot of lives by their diligence, and I think that they are really fantastic people, and I think that they are also fantastic people because they involve many Somalis. I mean, we tend to look at these famines as, in a way, as you know, the rich West going to help the poor Africans. Well, that's not necessarily the case. We are the rich West, but if we do the job properly, we also involve educated Somalis and those Somalis who are well enough to work in the process. And I think that the Red Cross did a good job of that, and Irish Concern did a good job of that. I mean, not all Somalis are warlords or gun-toting teenagers, or if they are gun-toting teenagers, they are gun-toting for reasons that they can't control, and many of them would prefer not to have the guns. So that's a bit off the track, but I did want to make that point.
Mm-hmm. When you'd go to Somalia for one of the 3-day stints, would you take food with you?
Yes, just actually I'm a great believer in chocolate. It gives you a lot of energy, and while it melted a lot in the heat, Fiona and I would pack chocolate and cheese and a packet of crackers. But I must say, for the most part, the International Committee of the Red Cross and Irish Concern were extremely generous in putting us up at night and sharing their cooked meals. So we would take some for an emergency, but we didn't take boxes full.
Was it always tempting to give away the food that you did bring to people who were starving?
Worst thing you could do, absolutely.
Well, why?
Well, because you create create havoc, stampede, and it's just not fair to the people who are running the feeding centers. I mean, it sounds callous on my part, I suppose, but of course, in a quiet situation, it was wonderful to be able to give chocolate to people. But you can't give chocolate to absolutely starving people. I mean, they can't take it. So it was useful to people who are helpful and so forth.
My guest is New York Times reporter Jane Perlez. In January, she returned to the States after covering Africa for 4 years. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jane Perlez. She reported from Africa for the New York Times for 4 years. She returned from Africa in early January, and soon she's headed off to Eastern Europe for the New York Times. Could you give us a sense of how you would decide each week what country you were going to go to and what you were going to cover? I mean, how many countries were on your... how many countries were you responsible for?
Oh, I think it was about 16, and some very interesting ones. Well, they're all interesting, but from the Horn of Africa down to Mozambique and including Madagascar, a place I visited only once, unfortunately. It was very interesting. In many ways, I tried to cover things generically rather than country by country. So, for example, if I thought that it was time to write a story on a particular angle about AIDS, I would think or make some calls and find out where was the best place to illustrate this point. Or if I wanted to write a story about the overwhelming desire of many African women to have many children, even though the mothers themselves might have AIDS, or even though it might become too much of an economic burden, I would look for a place to illustrate that. In that instance, I chose to go to Rwanda, where the tradition of having very many children still continues, despite government efforts at a family planning program.
You wrote a lot about AIDS in Africa, and you had at least one article about cultures that practice polygamy, where the husband has several partners and the women are expected to have only one, leaving the women very vulnerable to HIV.
Mm-hmm.
How aware were the men and the women you spoke to about AIDS and about the way that it's transmitted?
Well, again, it depended. In the cities, I think they were quite aware, and in the rural areas, less aware. I think in Uganda, for example, the women that I stayed with were vaguely aware that AIDS could be transmitted sexually, but they had no way to protect themselves, and they didn't really know about condoms, which were A, not available, and B, very foreign to them. So, yes, they were dimly aware, but didn't know how to handle the problem.
Were there inequities that you saw in your travels through Africa? Inequities about the about women's role in the culture or women's rights in the culture that you wanted to write about?
There are terrible inequities, and I think the women are aware of them, but again, have little way of dealing with them. Among the inequities are the fact that women produce 70% of Africa's food. How do they do this? They do this by hoeing in the fields, by carrying water, by planting, by harvesting. They do all the hard physical labor when it comes to agriculture. And in many parts of, in some of the areas that I traveled in, even an oxen-drawn plow was an advanced form of technology. So a very common scene is to see women bending over in the fields all day. They then come back to the small home and do all the cooking and the food, also having gathered the food, I guess, at some point during the harvest, they do all the cooking, prepare the children. Very, very physically arduous life.
Did you often travel alone?
Most of the time.
Yeah. Well, do you feel like you were up against anything different from a male counterpart would be, you know, as a woman traveling alone?
Not really. I mean, I would go to a capital and I'd have a list of contacts and not at all. I can't think of one instance where I felt that, and that includes places as diverse as Khartoum, Addis Ababa, Maputo, and Kampala. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are not a lot of Western reporters in Africa, period, so maybe either when you turn up, you're a novelty, and so you are treated graciously. Africans are very gracious people to outsiders, extremely gracious.
Is there any one story that you would single out as being a story that you thought was particularly important or particularly moving that you'd want to let us know about, those of us who might have actually missed it when it was in the paper? We tend to focus more on some stories than others, and I think all of us are often too busy to read everything that we want to have read.
Oh, I don't think so. I do think, though, that the early stories that I wrote from Somalia in the middle of last year with the photographs from Fiona McDougall were, from our point of view anyway, very moving and important stories. I think that they did alert people to the fact that the United Nations had not been in Somalia when perhaps they should have been. But I guess as a journalist you always remember those that you think have had some impact, and also that you remember because of the Somalis who were involved. I mean, there is a story that I guess I feel very close to, which involved a young Somali boy, Mohammed. Early on in the famine, we arrived at Baidoa, and we were met by an Irish Concern nurse, Anita, who had worked in many famines before, and this particular afternoon she was particularly outraged because, of course, she'd been there for a couple of weeks and had seen horrific things, and she was very angry that the aid agencies were so late in Somalia. And when we got to Baidoa this particular afternoon, she was at the airport to meet the United Nations plane, which was the first plane in with, I think, some biscuits and food, and she said, you know, it really didn't have to be this way. Why weren't people here? I've just had a boy, A boy came, was wheeled into the feeding center this morning on a wooden cart, and he was given up for dead, and he was put under a tree. He was lined up with the 15 other bodies that were ready for burial. And I went along and touched each body, and Mohammed, this young boy, he was alive, said Anita. And when I touched him, some tears rolled down his eyes. Rolled out of his eyes, and I said, "This is Anita speaking. What can I do for you? And what can I do?" And Mohammed said, "Can you please give me some honey, like my father used to do? My father is dead. My mother is dead. My brothers and sisters are dead. All this boy wanted was some honey. Of course, he was too sick and too frail to even have the honey." So Fiona and I accompanied Anita back to the feeding center. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was very cold. Everybody who had been at the feeding center that day had sort of been dismissed. This was not a place where you slept overnight, except here was Mohammed huddled in one corner. And Irish Concern was so short of supplies that they, through no fault of their own, but food was the first thing, but they were so short of supplies that this boy was being covered by cardboard cartons, which were held down in the wind by stones. They didn't even have any blankets. So Anita said to this United Nations official, "Hey, Trevor, where are the blankets?" So fortunately, the next week, some blankets came in. With some special attention, Mohammed gradually got stronger. But I want to tell you that I first saw him, I guess it was the middle of August, and he wasn't really well until November. So even with all the loving care and special attention that Irish Concern gave this one particular boy, a boy of about 13, it took all that time from mid-August to November for him to become at least physically normal again. I'm happy to say that he is. Last time I saw him in December, and he was so well, he was a little on the pudgy side, which is very gratifying. But that is a story and a characters that I will always remember.
Do you have the urge to keep in touch with him or other people you met with Somalia, or are you resigned to just moving on to something else?
Oh, I'm not resigned to moving on to something else. I found that I think the Somalis are very resilient people. They're very proud of their culture, and Mohammed will probably somehow do just fine within the Somali culture. And Anita will go on to be continue to be a terrific nurse in famines like this.
You're on your way to Warsaw now to cover Eastern Europe for the New York Times. What are you doing to prepare?
Well, funnily enough, I'm working on the business desk after 20 years of reporting in New York City and Washington. I did quite well in the capital of capitalism without knowing anything about business, but now I'm going to the post-communist world and I have to know a bit about business, so it's very stimulating for me to learn a bit about economics and how a stock market works and what mutual funds are in preparation for the new capitalism in Eastern Europe.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all.
Jane Perlez reports for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more on Africa from journalist Raymond Bonner, who just returned from 4 years there. He says American attention may soon be focused on the Sudan. Bonner is also the author of books about American support of repressive regimes in El Salvador and the Philippines. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Mad Dog and Glory, starring Robert De Niro, Bill Murray, and Uma Thurman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Federal law enforcement officials have announced the arrest of a suspect in connection with the bombing last week at the World Trade Center in New York City. Officials also say that a search is underway for other suspects in the bombing. The man now under arrest is expected to be arraigned later tonight in New York. And there are reports that his arrest came after efforts to retrieve a deposit made on a rented van heavily damaged in the Friday blast. Last week's explosion killed at least 5 people and injured more than 1,000 others. At the UN, Serbian leader Radovan Karadzic of Bosnia has retracted a statement that he made earlier this week, in which he warned that the U.S. might be the target of terrorist attacks. The move came after he was criticized by UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali and Secretary of State Warren Christopher. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Karadzic's statement set off a storm of controversy. In an open letter to the American people issued on Tuesday, he said the recent bombing of the World Trade Center in New York was fresh testimony to the immediate dangers of foreign involvement in Bosnia. It was unclear if the statement was an attempt to blame Bosnian Muslims for the blast or was a veiled warning to Washington to cease its humanitarian relief airdrops. In the same letter, Karadzic had said the airdrops could transform a local conflict into a Balkan war and perhaps a world war. Today, Karadzic said his remarks were distorted by a translator. He said that what he really meant to do was to express concern that a terrorist act could occur in the U.S. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
The Pentagon says that most U.S. forces will leave Somalia by June. A force of 3,000 to 5,000 U.S. troops will remain to assist U.N. operations in the famine-stricken country. NPR's John Greenberg has more on the story.
If the plan is accepted by the U.N. Security Council, U.N. forces will take control of Somalia on May 1st. A Pentagon spokesman says that the actual withdrawal of American forces will take longer as authority is handed over sector by sector. Many details are still being worked out between the U.S. and the U.N. At this point, several thousand Americans may stay behind. Some will help with jobs such as water purification and intelligence. An unspecified number will be part of a quick reaction force. That force may be based in Somalia. It would use attack helicopters and highly mobile troops to deal with a possible resurgence of heavy fighting between rival clans. Under the Secretary General's plan, the UN will have about 20,000 armed troops in the country. This is John Greenberg at the Pentagon.
The government says that the number of first-time claims for unemployment benefits moved up in the latest reporting week. The Labor Department says that new claims for jobless benefits climbed by 26,000 to 351,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 5 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton has signed a bill that extends jobless benefits to the long-term unemployed. Mr. Clinton said that extending jobless benefits is part of his long-term economic package, and he called on Congress now to approve the rest of the plan that calls for a short-term $30 billion stimulus and long-term tax increases and spending cuts to cut the nation's deficit. Former President Jimmy Carter met with President Clinton today at the White House. Mr. Carter was invited to discuss his efforts to improve the nation's inner cities with the president, the vice president, and cabinet secretaries. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Carter appeared at ease in the White House briefing room, noting that since he no longer has use of Air Force One, he had a plane to catch. He told reporters that he's been alarmed at the rate the nation's inner cities have been deteriorating. "We know how to reverse this downward trend," he said. "We want the federal government to be a partner." President Carter made it clear he was not seeking any additional funding.
"We want to make sure that the funding and the programs are already there in the Departments of Labor and Housing and Urban Development, Health and Human Services, Education, and so forth, are expended more effectively.
President Carter described President Clinton as very eager and receptive to new ideas about how to deliver services better, such as food stamps. He said he cautioned the new administration against depending on new programs to solve old problems. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
In Germany, Parliament has started consideration of measures to limit the number of refugees entering the country. Government officials say under an open-door policy, nearly all of the 440,000 new people in the nation last year were there for economic reasons and are blamed in part for a surge in right-wing violence. Germany's parliament is expected to approve laws to limit the number of people entering the nation, with entry promised only to war victims and those under oppression at home. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the current issue of Mother Jones magazine, journalist Raymond Bonner issues this warning. Unless the United States is prepared to become not only the world's policeman, but the world's missionary, we will have to address the UN's institutional failures in Somalia. Bonner just returned from 4 years in Africa, where he reported for The New Yorker and wrote a book about conservation controversies, which will be published this spring. He went to Africa when his wife, Jane Perlez, became the New York Times correspondent there. Bonner is a former Times reporter. When he was the paper's correspondent in El Salvador, Time magazine called him the most energetic and controversial reporter on the scene. Bonner says the Somalis distrust the UN. I asked him why.
There are a number of reasons. In part, it was during the Siad Barre regime when he was the dictator. The UN was putting money into the country, and many Somalis saw the UN as propping up Siad Barre. But perhaps more significantly, Terry, during the year 1991, when there was really a horrendous war going on in Somalia, the UN was nowhere to be seen. I mean, it's been described as one of the most critical 15 months in Somali's history, and the UN simply wasn't there. It was the time that the UN should have been playing a very active, very positive role, both on humanitarian relief, but also politically, using its offices to try to bring about a settlement of the clan fighting. If the UN had acted at that time, we would not have had the famine that we had. It's important to realize that this is a war-caused famine, not a weather-caused famine. It's man's famine, not nature's famine.
Do you think the UN missed opportunities when it could have done productive things in Somalia?
Yes, yes. It's not only a case of the UN not having taken the initiative. It even spurned opportunities to act. There were two occasions when Somalis approached UN officials at a very high level and asked the UN to use its good offices to try to reach a political settlement. And both times the UN actively said no. The UN said, we do not want to get involved. And for the Mother Jones piece, I got access, in fact, to a cable that had been sent from New York to Somali leaders saying they should be discouraged from trying to involve the United Nations, the Secretary General's office in New York. And that at a time when the UN might have played a role that could have reached a political settlement, and then we could have avoided these problems.
Where was home base for you when you were living in Africa?
We lived in Nairobi.
I know you made a lot of trips into Somalia, right?
A few. I didn't make that many into Somalia. Actually, we went one of the most amazing trips, I suppose, or revealing and staggering, was in December of 1991. We went to Somalia, and at that time the carnage was just unbelievable. I mean, I've been in Central America, I've been in Asia, I was never in Beirut, but this was carnage like I'd never seen. I mean, bodies lying all over the place, hospitals, just blood pouring down the hallways practically. No medication, no facilities for caring these people. It was anarchy at its worst. I mean, there were young men roaming the streets, just firing their weapons indiscriminately, no discipline of any kind, firing anti-aircraft weapons down the street. And I remember talking to one man who said he'd been sitting in a market, and whoosh, came a shell, and the legs were blown off a friend sitting next to him. Saw a little boy in a hospital yard. His leg had been blown off. His whole family had been killed when an artillery shell landed in his yard. As we stood there in this hospital yard, and it was outside the hospital. People, there wasn't even any room in the hospital to bring in the wounded. As you stood there, every second, a new batch of wounded people was being brought in. You know, men with their guts shot out, women legs shot off. I mean, it was carnage, just unbelievable. This was in December of 1991. It was a time when the world simply didn't pay much attention. Jane came back and wrote what was a front page piece for the New York Times. I actually wrote, at the time, was writing for the New Yorker and wrote a Talk of the Town piece. But there was no international attention. This was also a time, Terry, where the UN, this was right after the UN had been asked to use its offices to try to reach a political solution, had declined. And nothing, and then the war broke out at its worst. There was no Cyrus Vance, no Lord Owen, no senior official, and the UN was not even in Somalia. So the world really wasn't paying much attention to Somalia in December of 1991.
So you were onto the story before the World's Press Corps landed in Somalia. Then, okay, the World's Press Corps came to Somalia. But you were also looking at a lot of other stories in Africa at the same time. Do you think that there's a lot of African stories that we're overlooking as we're focusing on what's happening in Somalia?
Well, there's one that's extremely relevant right now to Somalia, and that's in Sudan. If we went into Somalia for humanitarian purposes, there's going to be American troops in Sudan in 18 months, if not sooner, because the famine in southern Sudan may be worse than the famine in Somalia. When the pictures start coming out of the stick-like figures, of the emaciated people, of the horror, you know, the people dying from starvation, then there's going to be pressure to get involved. You have ethnic cleansing going on of tribes, of ethnic groups in the southern Sudan. It's just not being reported at the moment, which is not a criticism of the press necessarily, but we can come back to that. And in the Sudan, you have there are American and Western, if you will, Western interests at stake. You know, and I say that because it used to be a tenet of American foreign policy and of most countries' foreign policy that you only sent troops abroad when interests were threatened. We had no interests threatened in Somalia. We went in for purely humanitarian reasons. In Sudan, there is an argument to be made that we do have interests in the Sudan and that they are being threatened, and that is because of the government in Khartoum. I mean, the Sudanese government, the government in Khartoum, is an Islamic fundamentalist dictatorship, is what it is. And its human rights record probably ranks up there along with North Korea's, a few places like that that are still left. It is a horrible government, brutally oppressing its people and carrying out a war against the southerners, those who live in southern Sudan. I mean, essentially, in simplest terms, the Khartoum government, the government in Khartoum, the Sudanese government, is Arab and Islamic, and the people living in the south are African and either Christian or animist. And there are security interests at stake. The Khartoum government has cozied up to Saddam Hussein, is probably getting support of some kind from Saddam Hussein. There have been reports that terrorists now find it possible to move in and out of Khartoum with relative ease because the government has not tried to control them. There have even been reports that there may be training camps in northern Sudan.
My guest is journalist Ray Bonner. He just returned from 4 years in Africa. He's a former New York Times correspondent and reported for the paper on El Salvador. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Raymond Bonner is my guest. In the New York Times, when you were writing for the Times, you reported on a massacre in a village, El Mazote, which was questioned by the U.S. government, questioned by some other journalists. You were criticized for just siding with the leftists in El Salvador and for being politically biased. And recently there was a team of forensic archaeologists who were sent to that village, and they uncovered bones and, I believe, a mass grave. And that seems to pretty well confirm that there was a massacre there. You did a wonderful report interview about this with Scott Simon on Weekend Edition on a recent Saturday. There are a couple of things I wanted to ask you, though, about that about that story. First of all, let me give you a chance to correct anything I got wrong in that little summary.
You were just you're much too diplomatic and polite, Terry, to say that the government questioned the reports and that I was criticized. I mean, the government didn't question them; they denied that a massacre had taken place. They flat out denied it. The American ambassador at the time, Ambassador Hinton, said they sent somebody up to investigate and they found no evidence of a massacre. It's simply not true. They sent somebody up to investigate, and in fact, the person came back and said, they didn't do a very good job of investigating, but in fact, the person said, we believe there was a massacre. You know, the State Department went, a senior State Department official, Assistant Secretary for Latin America at the time, Tom Enders, went up to the Hill and testified and said, simply, we have no evidence that a massacre of this level took place. And then the Wall Street Journal editorial ran a, you know, an entire editorial. They didn't bother to divide it that day in two, and said that I had been overly credulous in believing the peasants, that I had gone out on a limb in reporting about this massacre. And in fact, these same peasants are now the ones who are being cited on the front page of the New York Times, as you say, and elsewhere. It was providing evidence that, in fact, there had been a massacre, just as we had reported it.
What was it like for you as a journalist to have your credibility challenged like that, to have your credibility impugned? And how did you try to defend yourself?
There's no way you can. Yes, you know, it is unpleasant. It didn't feel very good to be attacked the way I was. It was all part of the ideological temper of the Times at that time. It was a very conservative era, as you remember. There was a lot of red-baiting going on. Mm-hmm. Central America was the ideological fault line. That's where Washington, the Reagan administration, was fighting what it perceived to be the holy war against communism. You know, as the ambassador used to say, former ambassador Robert White used to say, you know, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, all the way up to the soft underbelly of Kansas. That's the way it was. I mean, he didn't believe that. He used to say it in criticizing the U.S. policy. That's what that all was about. But there's nothing you can do. I mean, you report what happened, and you can't defend yourself. That's not what a journalist does. A journalist writes what he or she sees, and when the criticism comes, it comes. I mean, it goes with the territory. Look, we give our lumps, we take our lumps. I was writing for the New York Times. There's a lot of benefits of being a New York Times reporter, obviously, but part of the territory is when you write something, it has a greater impact, and so you're going to be criticized. You know, Alma Guillermo Prieto was a Washington Post reporter at the time. She wrote the same story, the same massacre story. We were not in there together. We were in there separately, saw it separately, and wrote it. But she, the Wall Street Journal, when it did its editorial and other criticisms that were later leveled at the reporting about the massacre, tended to single out me and the New York Times. Not me because I was Ray Bonner, but because I was with the New York Times, and on a story like that, the New York Times had more power even than the Washington Post. But it's all ideological, Terry. I mean, look, I've written about other massacres. I mean, you were right when you noted that I was accused of political bias. I mean, it was even stronger than that. I mean, I was accused publicly of being a leftist sympathizer. I think even in one case, I was accused of being a Marxist on public television. You know, it's all ideological because I've written about massacres by the Shining Path in Peru. I've written about, I wrote a piece about the Saddam Hussein's massacre of the Kurds, probably one of the best pieces I ever reported. No, nobody criticizes that reporting, i.e. nobody in Washington criticizes that reporting. The administration doesn't criticize that reporting because reporting about human rights abuses and massacres by Saddam Hussein or by the Shining Path in Peru fits in with their ideological agenda or American foreign policy.
You say everything's ideological. Your forthcoming book is on controversies over wildlife conservation in Africa. And I think you've been getting some heat from liberals about that because you're not taking a stand that they support.
Yeah, I thought the criticisms I'd taken from the U.S. government to reporting about American foreign policy were sharp and pointed. Boy, it's nothing like the attacks that have already started. I mean, the book's not even out yet. It's not even going to be out for another month. It's just from a piece that was in the New York Times Magazine that has already brought an incredible number of letters to the New York Times Magazine where it was excerpted, and also to the publisher, even before publication. You know, it's basically, the book doesn't take the standard line on conservation. I mean, basically, the book says there's more to conservation than animals. You've got to do something about people as well.
So what kind of heat are you getting for it?
Well, it's primarily people who've never been to Africa, don't understand anything about Africa, don't really care about the African people, and think you've got to do whatever you can all the time to save every individual animal, and don't understand the complexities of conservation. You know, they're just, accusing me of being an elephant killer, one letter said, you probably believe in clubbing baby seals to death, too, don't you? I mean, it's all emotional. Terry, it's very similar to the attacks that came, the political attacks that came from Washington when I wrote about massacres in El Salvador. You write about things that people don't want to hear, and they don't want to hear it, and that's the point. They're going to do whatever they can to criticize you.
Journalist Raymond Bonner, his article on the United Nations and Somalia is in the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. This is Fresh Air. A suspect has been arrested in the bombing of the World Trade Center. Linda Wertheimer, I guess that's your lead story on All Things Considered.
It certainly is, Terry. We'll have several takes on it, and we're trying to get information as current as we can find. It's coming out in dribs and drabs about who has been arrested and why the bombing happened. We'll stay with the story throughout the night. The Bosnian Serbs, we hear, although these reports are conflicting, may have allowed UN observers into some of those areas of eastern Bosnia. Wendy Kaufman will have a report for us on the LAPD trial. We'll talk to someone who has been personally and sadly affected by the floods in Yuma, and we'll have letters.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When John McNaughton directed his first film, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, he couldn't have imagined that his gritty, low-budget shocker would lead directly to the big time. But Henry caught the attention of Martin Scorsese, who hired McNaughton to direct a new movie written by Richard Price with an all-star cast, Robert De Niro, Bill Murray, and Uma Thurman. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Mad Dog and Glory.
The odds of making a fresh, cliché-free cop movie grow dimmer nearly every week, so I found myself perking up at the beginning of Mad Dog and Glory. This is a film about cops and malls and mobsters, but they're not your usual cops and malls and mobsters. For instance, there's Wayne, played by Robert De Niro. The gang at the precinct house jokingly calls him Mad Dog because he's a timid loner who can't bear the thought of drawing a gun. Mostly he doesn't have to. Wayne's a police photographer, great at gathering and analyzing evidence, scared stiff when it comes to rough stuff. But one night he walks into the middle of a convenience store holdup, and though he doesn't have the nerve to shoot the crazed young robber, he does talk him into leaving, thus saving the life of an unusually surly shopper the thief has been holding at gunpoint. That shopper is Frank, And as Bill Murray plays him, he's an even more original creation than Wayne. Frank's a gangster, or as he prefers to call himself, an expediter. But that's not all. He's also a stand-up comic and a psychoanalysis patient who takes his shrink's views very seriously. In fact, his shrink thinks he should show a little gratitude to the man who saved his life. And so Frank sends Wayne a very expensive present. Her name is Glory, and she's played by Uma Thurman. And when she arrives at his apartment, poor befuddled Wayne doesn't know what to do except offer her a hot drink.
How's the coffee?
It's so rich, I can't believe it's instant.
Yeah, well, anyways, I have to go to work now.
So, I'll stay here?
Oh, this is my house, so,
I'm not gonna steal anything.
Look, what's Frank's phone number?
Talk to me before you talk to Frank, okay? Look, you saved his life. He wants me to be your friend for a week. That's all, I swear. I'm like a thank you present. I'm a seven-day singing telegram. I'm like one of those people that comes to your door in a gorilla suit with balloons, you know?
Okay. Stop. Look, I gotta get out of here. I work straight through the night. I come back 6:37 in the morning.
No problem.
The problem with so many Hollywood movies these days is that all the punch is in their premise. Once that's stated, the movie makers too often have nowhere to go. Mad Dog and Glory goes nowhere fast. When its three quirky characters are established, nobody seems to know what to do with them. Predictably, Wayne falls in love with Glory, and his love gives him more courage than he knew he had. But De Niro sabotages the characterization by bringing too much to it. He makes Wayne such a crabbed, inward-looking loser that he's almost scary. While the rest of the movie is saying he's shy, De Niro's performance is shouting he's demented. Uma Thurman delivers a lovely portrayal, but her character is so underwritten that it never begins to make sense. And Murray doesn't have enough to do. He's the most intriguing figure on the screen, yet mostly he's off it. Mad Dog and Glory is a fizzle. But there's a lesson in movie making to be learned from it. Quirkiness can be a good thing in a genre film, as long as it's not the only thing.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dorothy Allison says she hates the whole literature of victimology and considers many books on incest to be pseudo-porn. We'll find out why, in spite of those misgivings, Allison wrote a novel based on how she was abused. It's just out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.